This is On Target St. John's. A look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon, everyone. As you may or may not already know, this is Heritage Week across the country, National Heritage Week. And of course, there's a number of events that are taking place in the province this week, including a little poster contest that took place yesterday. I always love those. They're great to see young people getting involved in our Newfoundland heritage, which is also important. But I thought this would be an excellent opportunity to bring in some guests who know all about heritage in Newfoundland and Labrador, and two of my guests are well known in that regard. We have the Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick. Hello.
Hello.
And I have Tyler Stapleton. He's with the President of the Newfoundland Labrador Historic Trust. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
No trouble. So, gentlemen, I invited you in here to talk heritage and other things related to Newfoundland and Labrador history and why heritage is so important. And I'll put the first question out to you, Jerry. Why is heritage so important?
Okay. Well, I think there are a whole bunch of reasons. One is it really reinforces a particular sense of identity and belonging to a place. And I mean, I think there's nowhere in the country like Newfoundland and Labrador where people have a sense of belonging. And, you know, our heritage is really an important part of that. I also think that it's one of the most important community assets that any community has in terms of potential for development for the future, because it's what makes that community different from the other community down the road.
Indeed, and our built heritage is a big part of that as well, and it's rather unique. Tyler, you've been working, of course, in that regard. What makes Newfoundland and Labrador built heritage so unique?
Well, that's an interesting question. You pay attention to any of the advertisements on TV, and you see these beautiful provincial ads for Newfoundland and Labrador, and you see the classic biscuit box house or the salt box house and the beautiful landscapes, and those heritage buildings are a huge, huge part of that. And if you try to imagine these ads and advertisements without these heritage buildings, it almost takes away our face. It's our identity. It's our community, as Jerry said.
And unique in a strange way, because you go just about anywhere else in North America and you won't see so many buildings that are made of wood. Most of them are brick or stone or whatever the case may be. It's kind of interesting that so much of our built heritage is actually wood.
I've thought a lot about that. I mean, you know, a place called The Rock, so few of our buildings were built out of stone. And the more I work with heritage buildings, I realize what a challenging environment it is for masonry buildings. You know, we get the driving rain, freeze-thaw. And whereas wood was very plentiful, in many cases, people could build their own houses out of those materials. So even though wood is a challenging material as well, keep the paint on and all that, that really does characterize much of our built heritage.
And you don't have to quarry it, which I would imagine takes an awful lot of work.
That's right.
So is that what's behind a lot of that and what makes our heritage, I guess, so vulnerable and unique?
Yeah, it is. It is very unique, and the building materials do have a large part to play. A little funny story: the fellow I work with lives on the southwest coast down in Rose Blanche, and if you're familiar with the area, very barren, a lot of granite cliff. And a gentleman from England actually visited, and he was talking to my coworker and said, "How come all the houses are built with wood? You don't have very many trees. You have lots of rocks, lots of granite, but you have wooden houses. Whereas in England, we have not very many. We have lots and lots of trees, but not a lot of rock. And it's the other way around with the stone buildings in England versus the wood buildings here." But it creates an interesting connection, you know, across the Atlantic with the styles of the buildings and also the materials that are used or the lack of materials are used. So that really makes it a unique place in Newfoundland for what we have, our built heritage.
The construction as well, because I've often heard, you know, the difference between the frame construction versus the balloon construction, and how the balloon construction is a lot more sound when it comes to some of the elements that we deal with on a regular basis, you know, hurricane force winds and the like. Does that make a big difference?
Well, actually, wood, believe it or not, can stand up quite well to wind. I mean, I don't think since I've lived in Newfoundland and Labrador for 35 years, I've ever lived in a house that didn't shake in a storm. But it's got that flexibility that that it can withstand the elements. And it's kind of interesting to me to see that as often our older buildings, our traditional ones, that stand up better in a storm than some of the modern ones. I mean, you know, you have a big windstorm and you're picking off somebody's vinyl siding off your front step, you know?
Indeed, it is rather unique, isn't it? And is that why, you know, the structures tend to be a little bit smaller and these kinds of things because of the weather? Did weather shape the way in which we build our houses?
I would say for sure. And not only the way we shape them, but the way we design them with, you know, their orientation. Are they facing south for the sun? Or the size of the windows to get the most light in the evenings and these type of things. Whereas, you know, modern developments now in subdivisions, the houses could be facing any which way. But, you know, you look at traditional buildings in Newfoundland, they're usually always facing the sea or try to have a southern exposure for the light, because you look back when these buildings were built, before electricity, you got up with the crack of dawn and you went to bed when it got dark. So, you know, it goes beyond just the look of the building, but the actual use of the building, how it was used and the people who lived in it.
And if I can just add, I think it was also based on a lot of experience. You know, people figured out what worked and didn't work. And so it's kind of interesting to look particularly at the fisheries heritage. You know, you look at how these buildings that are hanging out over the water are often supported, and they look like, how can that withstand? But yet they do so in a better way than often the newer structures. So, you know, a lot of this is based on hard-won experience.
Indeed, and there's an evolution also involved in our built heritage. We often hear, you know, the first generation, second generation, the salt box. One of my big pet peeves, and I'm sure it's similar to you. Everybody thinks they've got a salt box, but a salt box is a very specific kind of construction. Who wants to walk us through some of the evolution of traditional Newfoundland architecture?
Sure. Well, I guess from documentation, some of the earliest buildings were very, very simple. You know, they were just little huts, basically. The salt box form seems to have been very, very common, you know, in the early period. If you look at historic photographs, for example, you know, anything prior to the 1880s, virtually everything was a salt box form house. And then, you know, as different building materials came in, why did you need a salt box or a steep roof? Because you were using wood shingles and you needed to shed that water. Then when you got tar paper, well, you didn't need to do that. And so the slope of the roof can come down. So technology definitely played a role as well. But it's really interesting. We did a social media piece at the foundation a few months back on that whole thing of salt box versus biscuit box. And like, we had thousands of hits on that one. So it generated a lot of interest. A woman from Nova Scotia even called me to ask me whether her house was a salt box or a biscuit box.
Do we have a lot of salt boxes left?
I think the numbers are declining. I think, you know, with these steep pitch roofs, like you say, as development and materials advanced, you've seen a lot of these houses being cut down. I know my next door neighbor was a mansard roof with the slope front and back, and back in the 50s and 60s that was cut down to two stories and just put a more simple roof on it. So these building styles and structures, they can change and be adapted over time, and they can also be like historical adaptations where something could have changed 100 years ago, and that also becomes a part of the fabric. And speaking of fabric and materials and how technologies change, the best thing that I love about historic buildings with wood materials and honest materials that last is that they're repairable. You know, you can repair wood and you can make these repairs. You have wooden windows. You can do maintenance on these and repair them. If you have vinyl siding that cracks or splits, you need to replace a full piece of vinyl siding. Or if your vinyl window, the seal goes, well, you need to take the full window out and put in a new window. Whereas, you know, a traditional wooden window or a wooden storm, if a section of glass breaks, well, you can scrape out the old putty, cut a new piece of glass, pop in your new piece of glass, and re-putty it, and your window could be good for another 100 years. So it's an honesty in materials, and they're not only their durability, but their ability to be repaired.
The skills involved in that, was it passed down generation to generation, or were there plans You know, you often hear tell of, you know, Pop and his brothers getting together and building a house in an afternoon or something like that. You know, were these skills that were passed down generation to generation, or did somebody have something they could reference?
Definitely, the skills were passed down. We've been doing an oral history project with an older generation of carpenters, and in a number of instances, you know, their father, their grandfather, their great grandfather were also carpenters, and so you know, this is something I thought a lot about in terms of, well, how did we get this sort of kind of unified look in terms of the, if you go to Newfoundland Outport, how do we get that unified look, you know? And I think a lot of it was just that. I mean, there was such a thing, I guess, as tradition and custom. This is how you build a house. But I think a lot of it actually came from the experience and knowledge of the builders.
Jerry, also not only their experience and knowledge, but just what they had to work with. You know, the local materials, they couldn't just pop to a hardware store and buy what they needed. They had to, like when I think of my grandfather, the repairs that he made to his house, you know, and this was in a day and age where you could go to the store. He wouldn't want to if he didn't have to. He'd love to save things and recycle things and repair things.
Well, indeed, yeah, it was a lot more sustainable, wasn't it, in the long run?
Yeah, and one of the things, one of the challenges today in terms of conserving these older buildings is the lack of that knowledge being passed on to a younger generation. So, you know, a lot of carpenters, they get their training at college, and then they can go to the, you know, to Kent and get these kind of various building elements that you just plug into the building. But in terms of really understanding how these historic buildings are built and how you have to, the techniques you need to restore them, a lot of that is no longer around. So we're finding that increasingly a challenge.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about that coming up right after the break. My in-studio guest this afternoon, Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick, and the President of the NL Historic Trust, Tyler Stapleton. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. This is Heritage Week. My in-studio guest this afternoon, and this is a topic that I love. Anybody knows me knows that this is something that really gets my blood flowing. It's my in-studio guest today, Heritage NL Executive Director Jerry Dick, and Tyler Stapleton. He's the president of the Newfoundland Labrador Historic Trust. And during the break, we were talking a little bit about unique elements. Are there certain areas or districts in the province that have elements that you don't see in other areas? Because we talked a little bit about, you know, this sort of homogenized look of a Newfoundland home that's in many areas, even widely dispersed areas, houses look very similar. However, there must be some, you know, regional variations. Are there?
Without a doubt, somewhat different building practices, somewhat different decorative elements. So in the case of Bonavista, there was this several generations of the Strathy family were builders. And so you see particular decorative elements that you see almost nowhere else. Or in some communities like Tilting on Fogo Island, many of the houses are built on just on little piles or stilts, which you don't see in a lot of other places. So you definitely see variation. Also, depending on the age of the community, so some of the older communities might have more of those, you know, gable roof, the steeper roof, and then maybe later communities like along the south coast or whatever, more what we call the biscuit box with the shallow roof.
Anything stand out for you, Tyler? You were talking about some regional differences even within the city.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Like you can compare the West End to the East End, and even more narrowly focused, you can go down street by street basis and see an influence in my part of town in the old West End. Kind of a unique window style where you'll have a bank of three windows next to each other with these rounded arch tops. And again, you might see these in other parts of the city, but there seems to be a greater number in that area. And not only just of this type of detail, but other details as well that can be found in different areas.
That's a class thing as well. I mean, wealthier people could afford a more expensive home, maybe a designer, whereas you get, you know, some of the back streets, the, you know, very simple little modest houses, you know, colorful and certainly really, you know, important part of the character of St. John's, for example.
Before the break, you were talking a little bit about some of these skills that were passed down generation to generation. Is there a risk that we might be losing some of those essential skills?
Without a doubt. For example, you know, Tyler was talking about being able to restore windows. We partnered actually with the Historic Trust back in the fall to do a workshop on restoring wooden windows, because there's not a lot of people who actually, very few people who can do that. We find with historic masonry, we don't have a lot of people who really understand how that works. And if you don't, you can definitely do the wrong thing. And over the years, we've seen some improper interventions on buildings that actually have caused problems down the road. So as an example, the Anglican Cathedral, they're having to take out all the cement mortar that was put in, I don't know, in the 80s or 90s or whenever it was, because it's causing problems and, you know, at considerable expense. If you wanted to get a hard wall plasterer, not sure where you would go in this day and age.
And that was one of the challenges faced by the Roman Catholic Cathedral in Harbor Grace, I know, with the masonry and that sort of thing. There were some issues trying to find people who knew how to do those skills. Are there any particular properties that spring to mind when you think of at risk? Any properties that you say, this is something we need to focus on and preserve?
Where do I start? It's a pretty big question. I think if you look at it in areas where there's a lot of urban development, a lot of economic activity, that any property really is at risk of being demolished, I guess you could say. A lot of the certain older properties may be very grand or very large that your regular single family just are not going to maintain, as the once families did before. Or on the flip side of that, very small houses, very small row houses or small south box houses and biscuit box houses with low ceilings and things like that. So it can be an interesting challenge to try to fight and preserve these buildings, which are very valuable to our province as a whole and to our culture, our community, and our identity. And I think one of the biggest risks is, like I said, the economic push that we have, where the value of land can sometimes exceed the value of the building.
So what's the key to addressing some of that?
Well, I think we have almost opposite problems in urban and rural parts in the province. So, you know, as Tyler was saying, in St. John's, we have that development pressure because there's, you know, people want to build new things. In rural parts of the province, it's often the opposite. There's not a lot of economic activity. There's no longer a demand for certain buildings. I think the real key to this is trying to get ahead of the curve on it. So rather than waiting until it's a crisis point where, you know, there's a threat for the property to be torn down, we actually think about, okay, what buildings do we think might become redundant over the coming year? So we could think of, you know, historic churches, government buildings, community buildings. Or some of these, you know, substantial properties that, you know, people just can't afford to live the way they used to anymore, is that we identify them, engage the public in trying to find what new uses could these buildings be put to? You know, what's kind of the highest and best use for that, you know, in terms of economic opportunities or community opportunities? So I think it's being more proactive than we have in the past, because usually by the time it comes to, you know, a group mounting a protest, it's often too late.
Well, indeed, and that's what it seems like. It's not until, you know, you're at the 11th hour that people suddenly rally and try to bring some attention to a matter. We saw that with Richmond Cottage and some other properties in and around the city. Institutional properties, there's, you know, work underway to try to replace the Waterford Hospital and HMP. Important work. It has to be done. But what about the buildings after they're finally vacated? Do they have value?
Yeah, I would like to think that every building has a value in some sense. So we're in a culture of recycling and reuse, and adaptive reuse are two really big buzzwords that play into the heritage community. We recently awarded two properties there this year in our 35th annual Southcott Awards, the Bannerman Brewing Company building on Duckworth Street, where they reused the old East End Fire Hall and turned that into their venue. And you might not think of it as heritage or adaptive reuse, but you think about the old bus depot that's been now revitalized and reused as the community farmers market, the St. John's Farmers Market. So a lot of these buildings, you have to really think outside the box. Just because it was built as a house or it was built as a bus depot, it doesn't mean that it has to exist in that identity forever. And it takes a lot of, I think, community effort to get together and brainstorm and think, what does our community need? And what can we, where can we put it? And how can these heritage buildings help play a role?
And I think one of the starting points for that is really understanding what the heritage values of those properties are. And it might be, you know, historical, architectural, but there are also intangible values, you know, that say this old church or whatever the building might be, it's part of their life stories are wrapped up in these buildings. So, you know, I remember when I went to a 3-room school for my first grade, and one day I was in university already, I drove by, it was gone, there was grass there as though it never existed, and I felt it on a visceral level. And so we look at buildings like, you know, the penitentiary, and, you know, that has a very complicated history, as does the Waterford. But I think that, you know, before we make decisions about that, we need to really understand what the values of that property are. And another thing that Tyler touched on is increasingly we're looking at heritage as having playing an important part in terms of the whole green agenda, because it's often said that the most sustainable building is one, or the greenest building is one that's already built because of all the investment, you know, to make this brick, to get it to the site. And then you tear it down, you expend more, you know, energy, you build a new building. So increasingly we're looking at, you know, that's part of the importance of all of our building stock if it can be repurposed.
Are these conversations already being had, in particular about HMP or the Waterford Hospital? I'm thinking in terms of the HMP, because we all talk about its historic significance, because it is, you know, an older structure dating back to the 1860s, at least some of that building. Are there conversations about preserving even a portion of that structure?
These are government-owned buildings, so those are really conversations, I guess, within government. You know, what I hear is usually, you know, in passing, somebody says, yeah, what about this building? You know, the penitentiary, for example, is that something that could be saved? So, again, let's get out ahead of it before a decision is made to tear down or make redundant, to see what the possibilities are.
And even some buildings that you might associate with a very complex moral issues, I guess, if you want to put it that way, like they have maybe a very storied past or a dark past. You think of the history of HMP, or you think of the history of the Belvedere Orphanage, or you think of, you know, Mount Cashel. You think of residential schools. That a lot of these, sometimes these buildings have very challenging you know, ideals when they were built, I guess you could say. And it's important to acknowledge that and to realize that there are people out there who had some really bad experiences with these buildings. But then in the other sense, when I attended the National Trust Conference there last year in Winnipeg, there was a group of residential school survivors who are campaigning to preserve their residential school. They don't want that building torn down. They want that building to exist and stay there and have a new use to say, yes, this is what happened in the past. We know that we can build upon that and make a better future for ourselves. So it can be a really tricky and challenging issue, but it highlights the importance of getting all these groups together and having a community discussion.
Tyler Stapleton, the president of the Newfoundland Labrador Historic Trust and executive director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick are my in-studio guests this afternoon. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. This is Heritage Week. My in-studio guest this afternoon, the executive director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick, and the president of the Newfoundland and Labrador Historic Trust, Tyler Stapleton. And earlier in the show, we were talking a little bit about what's happening in St. John's and some of the challenges we faced here. And there's been some real heartbreakers, of course. We all remember Quinnipiac and Richmond Cottage. Those are two that really, you know, stand out when people talk about heritage in Newfoundland and Labrador, and sort of watching that whole process happen and most people feeling very helpless about it. So what can we do better in the capital city when it comes to the preservation of heritage?
Well, I think one of the things is to have a much better public engagement process so that when a new proposal comes forward or when somebody's even thinking about developing a site within a heritage neighborhood or area or a sensitive area, that we get the public involved and you know, articulating what their values are, but also what their ideas are. And so there have been a number of development proposals for downtown in the last year or so. I mean, the Atlantic Place Barton Garage is one. There was one immediately adjacent to the War Memorial that there were concerns about. One beside the Murray premises there on Water Street, there's a new development. The JAG Hotel. And a lot of these, I think, are not as sensitive to the historic fabric as they could be. And also, I think, not even necessarily following good design principles, because what we're seeing on a lot of these proposals is the lower levels are parking garage. So they give nothing to the street. You know, there's no longer a shop there. There's a fake window or a blank wall. So it really, I think, takes away from the special character of our downtown area. And I really think the key to that is better engagement with the public. And I can talk in a bit about, you know, some ideas we have for that.
Well, indeed. And is there enough in the regulations to sort of make this a happier place to live, to meld development with heritage?
I'd like to think positive and say there's room for improvement, and we can have a balance between development. We can have sensitive development that adds to the community, but we don't need to destroy our heritage to get to that point. We have to think about how at-risk heritage is. We go back a few months to the proposed annex to the cathedral, the Anglican Cathedral in downtown St. John's, and the fact that it was with the zoning rules and the fact that it was an addition, and just the way it all fell down the way it all played out, I should say, that a public meeting wasn't required. That's just how it happened. But the city's decided, I think we should have a public meeting, which good on them for having that. But they didn't go through the regular 2-week notification period. So we had 4 days notice to have a public response to this type of proposal. So it's not only the public engagement, but early. It needs to be early so that before the developer spends probably hundreds of thousands of dollars developing these plans of what they want to do, that we get everybody together and have an opportunity to say, you know, we value this, we'd like to see this, we think this might be changed to make a better environment and built environment.
And we're watching that play out now with the Parish Lane proposal. Where does that stand now, and how do you see that process?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good example maybe of how things could happen. So Heritage NL is collaborating with Happy City to do a public engagement process working with the developer. So we started out with a community survey, then we did a focus group, and on Thursday we're going to have a design charrette. So the idea is that we take the ideas that came out of the community consultation and we see if we can, you know, rejig and rethink some aspects of that proposal that can address those concerns that came forward from the public. And, you know, when we were talking about this with the architect, he said, geez, you know, we should have done this at the beginning. And that's exactly the point. So we're hoping that those in the development community will see that you don't need to be threatened by the public, you know, that it's good to hear what they have to say, what their ideas are that might make your proposal better. Tyler was talking about the National Trust Conference in Winnipeg, and there was a developer from Montreal, and they say they have a 3P kind of bottom line. It's people, profit, and planet. So by really finding out what the community wants, they have to spend very little on marketing because they're generally leased before their projects are even finished. You know, and the planet part is we do something that's sustainable, and of course they want to make a profit, but you can be profitable and you can also take the community's needs broadly into consideration.
And Parish Lane is already making some alterations to their plans and that kind of thing to address some of the very real concerns that have been out there in the community.
My understanding, there was a meeting at the Rooms, and the Rooms, you know, of course, they want to protect their incredible views. So I understand that, you know, there's been some conversation and some possible changes there. So, you know, and again, the developer, he's working along with this. I think he's interested to see what comes out of it. So we're hoping that this can show that there's a better way.
It doesn't have to be us and them.
Exactly.
You mentioned a very important word earlier, and you've repeated it throughout the course of the show, sustainability. And there's an argument to be made, Tyler, you had mentioned this earlier, about sustainability when it comes to heritage. Is it more Is it more environmentally sustainable to preserve a heritage structure or to tear it down and build anew?
I would say absolutely that there's a case to be made that preserving heritage is the preservation of climate. You look at these old buildings where you have quarried stone that was quarried locally. You have, you know, trees that may have been felled locally and brought site by horse and cart. You have iron nails that were made right in St. John's. So all these materials were close at hand, and they were built with local labor and things like this. So the carbon cost of building that building initially is, I can't say it was zero, but it was probably pretty close to zero when you look at our modern buildings that we have to import everything. But also, if you look at the demolition, if there's a statistic that was presented at the National Trust Conference that was researched by the American National Trust, and they studied the demolition cost of destroying these heritage buildings, and they had researched that if you demolish an historic building and you replace it with a building the same size, and that's 30% more efficient, that it will take 42 years of energy savings to pay off the demolition cost of that building. So you really think that you try to sell a new building, say, oh, it's super insulated and super green, and look at all the money we're going to save, it's super, super friendly. But if you knock down the 150-year-old building that was in pretty good shape to begin with, you're not starting off at a level footing. You're going backwards, if anything.
And I think there's the whole kind of environmental sustainability argument, but there's also the economic and community sustainability side of things. So, you know, there's statistics that show that to restore an historic building takes a lot more labor. It's much more labor intensive than materials. And let's face it, most of our materials are imported from somewhere else. So it creates more jobs than new construction might. As well, we've seen a number of communities, particularly on the Bonavista Peninsula, where their heritage is really part of their economic sustainability plan going into the future. I mean, look at Bonavista. It's all been based on preserving their heritage, and the place has really done a turnaround since the days of the cod moratorium.
And loads of exciting new businesses there, and small-scale manufacturing, and all of those things. The difference in a decade between Bonavista in the 90s, early 2000s, and now is so huge.
It's incredible.
It's amazing to watch that transformation, and yet you go there, and it's still the kind of place that you want to be, either as a visitor or a tourist or as a resident. So there is value in that as well.
There's great value, and I think one of the things that is, to me, really interesting about Bonavista, and you know, we compare it to Trinity, whereas Trinity, you know, it's very much about tourism, but the population, I don't know what the summer population is, but it goes down to about 35 permanent residents year-round, whereas in Bonavista, they're actually, I understand, attracting younger people, many of whom are starting up businesses, they're retaining people, just by creating a real quality of life in that community, and the population's increasing.
Something people are looking for, that groundedness, I suppose, that sense of belonging, because that's what we're talking about here in essence, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we started the program first talking about, you know, what is heritage, and heritage is this community and our identity. So it's a tool, I think, that links these different groups and different businesses and people who visit and local people that, you know, we can share in what we all enjoy and what we appreciate about our communities, and then heritage plays a role with that.
And maybe if I can add too, it's not only the built heritage either. Heritage NL, we have a program, a community heritage mapping program called People, Places, and Culture. It's a workshop that we offer to communities. So we ask whoever's interested to come out for an evening, and then just whether it be a story or a special place in the landscape or a tradition, whatever the case might be, plot it on the map somewhere. And so what you start to see are some themes emerging, some clusters, and then we use that as a basis for a conversation about what might you do to preserve this, what are some of the development opportunities that could come out of it. And I'll just give you one example. We did one of these workshops in Flat Bay on the West Coast, and there's a whole long tradition of guiding, of hunting and fishing guiding, and people are still doing that. And so we saw a possibility to, you know, pass those skills on to a younger generation and build on it. Maybe it's not all hunting and fishing, maybe it's kind of non-consumptive kind of experiences, but there's a tradition on which I think they could build.
It's fascinating. I mean, as soon as you said that, I thought immediately of the Gander Bay region and Glenwood and those things, and the Gander River boats mm-hmm. and all of those mm-hmm. things, very unique to those areas. It's a fascinating conversation. We're talking with Jerry Dick, he's the Executive Director of Heritage NL, and Tyler Stapleton, the President of the Newfoundland Labrador Historic Trust. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
We're back. This is Heritage Week. My in-studio guests, Executive Director of Heritage NL, Jerry Dick, and the President of the Newfoundland and Labrador Historic Trust, Tyler Stapleton. And earlier in the show, we were talking a little bit about lost skills and passing skills down. And I know Heritage NL has been doing a lot of work to try and preserve some of those skills. What kind of programs are you working on?
Well, I think I mentioned the window workshop we did back in the fall, and out of that came interest from the guys who were part of there. I think there were about a dozen people that took part in that, even just some additional kind of very basic things like use of traditional hand tools. How do you sharpen hand tools? So that they were interested in quite a few things. We've been working with the College of the North Atlantic for a while to actually develop a heritage carpenter or contractor certification program. It's kind of different than there have been heritage carpentry components that were part of the journeyman carpentry program. But what we found the problem with those was that, you know, a young person does their training and then they're off in Alberta and we've lost their skill. So they're working with those carpenters and contractors in our community to give them a certification. In some cases, it's just to certify what they already know. In other cases, maybe to give them some new information or new knowledge. So we're hoping to get that out there. We're collaborating with Parks Canada. We're planning on doing a heritage masonry course sometime in the late in the spring. And that would be like working with mortars and things like that. But even further down the road, maybe dry laid stone, which is a whole, you know, part of the tradition here. We're planning a linseed oil paint workshop here at some point in the spring. So
linseed oil paint? What?
Yeah. So one of the challenges, you know, it used to be, you know, we used, well, way back in the day, they used ochre paint with some kind of fish oil or seal oil, which is a very durable thing. Then we had oil paints. But today we have, we find there's some real challenge with some of the modern paints, like latex, which are really kind of like wrapping your wood in plastic, and everything has to breathe. Moisture gets in this province and it's got to get back out again. So there's a company out of Sweden that does a linseed oil paint. And what they do is they soak as much linseed oil into the wood as possible and then they paint it. And we've been told that this product is good for maybe 20 years. All you have to do is put a coat of linseed oil over it every so many years. So, and it also acts as a better wood preservative. So this is something that we want to explore here, and it's increasingly being used, especially in heritage examples.
Wow, sign me up. Tyler, we spoke a little bit about maintenance of older buildings and that kind of thing. Do you find that there's, because during the break we spoke a little bit about some of the issues you might run into when you have an older property, is sometimes it's not the problem that exists, it's the solutions to the problem that become even more problematic, if you know what I mean. Somebody went in there and did some kind of a fix-it job that wasn't familiar, I guess, with the work that had been done there. Do you find there's a little bit of a trouble when it comes to people who have gone in since and tried to fix up things that didn't have the skills necessary?
I think, yeah, that can be an issue. But I guess you can't knock these people if they didn't know what they're doing and all they wanted to do is just try to maintain their structure. But it does make a challenge for people now in the modern age, now that we have this research and these different technologies, and to go back and have to do over some of this work. But heritage, or the H word, if you want to call it, it doesn't need to be scary. You know, I think we need to get to a point where we have conversations with even home inspectors or real estate agents, where just because something is designated or as historic, it doesn't need to be, oh, I need to run a mile because it's going to cost a fortune. There's tools out there that, you know, Heritage NL and Jerry is working on, and there's folks out there who know these things and who are trained, and there's a knowledge base out there that we need to to share. A lot of it comes from people might not just know the difference, but if we just get out there and say, here's an example of a good news story, this is what's possible. You can restore your old wooden windows with single pane glass, and restored properly, they can be just as energy efficient as a vinyl replacement. So I think heritage is something that should be embraced. It can be embraced, and we should move forward to encourage that.
There's definitely people who have a passion for it, but do you need the pocketbook to back that up?
There's no question. I mean, heritage is heritage work is, especially if you're going to take a restorative approach, is often a premium. As I said before, it's really labor intensive. But I think we also have to factor in all of the costs, you know, which are also the environmental costs. You know, I'm a real believer that although certainly we use modern technology and materials and so forth in heritage, but I'm a believer that the old ways are often the best ways because they were tried and true. And some of the biggest problems with heritage buildings have been when somebody's tried to do something modern. So I mentioned before using a cement mortar, which is just too hard. You know, the water that gets into the wall can't leach back out, and it's harder, so it actually breaks up the brick around it in the freeze-thaw cycle. So I think, you know, understanding that those traditional skills, you know, it's not quaint, it's not, and a lot of the details were not decorative, they actually had a function in terms of helping to shed water away from the building or to protect a building component.
So we've got about 5 minutes left. Is there anything we're doing right? Any real success stories? I mean, we all reference Bonavista, you know, frequently, but there are any other little, you know, hidden gems in the province that are really making a mark?
That's a good question. I heard some news there recently about the Harbor Grace Cathedral. There's some good news coming out of that, where some folks have a plan to adaptively reuse that structure. I don't want to speak too much about that for what their plans are, but there are good news stories out there. Sometimes you have to dig a little bit to find them, not just in the province, but you can look at examples across the country where some of the issues that we face are quite similar in other areas, and it takes a community to get together and to make the connections to say, hey, look, there's a community in Ontario, for example, that had almost the exact same problem, and what were their lessons that they learned, and how would they go about it differently if they could do it again? So organizations like Heritage NL and also the Newfoundland Labrador Historic Trust, it's kind of our role to research this and look for it, but also share it to the public to show what's possible.
There are lots of great examples and things to celebrate. All across the province. A couple of years ago in our annual Heritage Day event, we created a Heritage Champions Award. And that was for those volunteers. These are buildings that are usually owned by a not-for-profit group or a municipality. Those volunteers who are so passionate and love their buildings and preserve them. So, you know, we had we gave an award to the Willow Tree Heritage Society, that lovely group of women in Hans Harbour, as well as the Blackhead committee that's looking after their old school and church. And it really warms my heart to see the passion and the creativity. A couple of years ago, we gave it to someone with the Fairyland Church, that stone church, and there's one woman who's just been passionate about it. And you know, if it wasn't her and a small group of volunteers, I wouldn't be around anymore. So I met with St. George's Church committee in Brigus on Saturday, doing a little bit of strategy work in terms of how they can, you know, come up with a sustainability plan. So there's lots of great examples, private sector, community sector, of preserving our incredible heritage.
And I know Linda White and others are working very hard in Greens Pond as well, another beautiful community, and they're trying to save that courthouse there. There's a lot of challenges, I know. It's not always easy.
It is. It's not. And it takes determination. But, you know, there are ways to do these things. You know, there are resources available through Heritage NL. We provide funding. We have technical expertise. We have ideas in terms of other sources of funding, how you approach that. So, you know, if you're determined and you got a good plan, you'll find a way to do it.
And it really does take that grassroots kind of effort, isn't it, for a lot of these, especially the institutional buildings like courthouses and schools and churches and those kinds of things, where a community says, you know what, this building means way too much to me and my family and my grandchildren for us to let it go.
Absolutely. I really have to give a shout out to all the community organizations across the province who are, you know, completely volunteer. They don't get paid. They're just doing it out of pure passion, and they want to preserve these structures or preserve these communities. And you really have to appreciate that there's a lot of challenges ahead in some situations, but it really comes down to individual people and groups that get together and say, you know, we really, really want to save this. And it has more than just an economic value. It's not just dollar signs, but it means more than that.
Tyler Stapleton with the Newfoundland and Labrador Historic Trust and Executive Director of Heritage and L. Jerry Dick, thank you very much for coming in this afternoon. Fascinating conversation. I really appreciate it. And anything that comes up in future, by all means, do give us a call and come on in. Our guest tomorrow is going to be a member of the Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder of NL organization. So that's going to be a fascinating conversation. Stay tuned for that.